More than anything else, what Musi and Prince needed was hard information, the specs of the camp, accurate reports on the whereabouts and strength of the enemy, the precise location of every pillbox and guard tower on the premises, recommendations on the best routes of ingress and egress. They needed to know the size and style of the padlock on the front gate. They had to ascertain where every fence was, how tall, and composed of how many strands of barbed wire. Were there drainage ditches, ravines, or other features that could provide cover? Exactly how many Americans were in there, and which barracks were they staying in? How many of them could walk, and how many would require litters? Where were the power generators, the radios, the telephone and telegraph lines? On and on the list went. In the most copiously detailed sense, the Rangers had to understand what they were up against. The vital information they needed, or at least the promise of it, came at last in the form of Bill Nellist and Tom Rounceville, two dusty, sweat-streaked, sun-scorched Alamo scouts. The Alamo scouts were a legendary unit of behind-the-lines intelligence gatherers that had been personally created by General Kruger earlier in the war. The scouts had already racked up an incredible string of successful exploits elsewhere in the Pacific, without losing a single man, including the flawless rescue of 66 Dutch POWs in the jungles of New Guinea. General Kruger and Horton White had dispatched 2 5-man squads of the scouts ahead of the Rangers to undertake a thorough reconnaissance of the camp and to prepare an intelligence report for Musi. Nellist and Rounceville were the 2 squad leaders. Thrilled to see fresh American faces after 2 long days, the 2 men rushed to greet Musi and Prince with exhausted smiles. However, they had bad news. The scouts were nowhere close to getting the goods. The recon report Musi and Prince so urgently needed was still a work in progress. The scouts had been working around the clock, carefully studying the perimeter of the camp. They'd made all kinds of preliminary sketches, and they'd mapped out the likeliest escape routes across the Pampanga River. But the most salient pieces of information, such as how many tanks were parked outside, how many Japanese troops were there, and precisely where they were quartered, still remained question marks. They didn't even have a definitive layout of the camp. "We can't get up close," Nellist explained. "It's flat as a pancake out there." What little information the Alamo scouts were able to glean was dismaying, to say the least. Day and night, the camp environs had been a nest of Imperial Army activity. The north-south road that ran directly in front of the main gate had seen a nearly uninterrupted flow of traffic, tanks, armored vehicles, transport trucks. "It looks like Main Street in Tokyo," Rounceville said. "The place is thick with Japs." It was a confusing mishmash of movement. While some of the enemy vehicles appeared to be retreating to the north, others were hastening south to fortify the garrison at Cabanatuan City, where the Japanese were evidently preparing to take a stand against the advancing 6th Army. Guerrilla reports indicated that as many as 7,000 Japanese troops were now assembled in Cabanatuan City. "And that's just over 3 miles southwest of the camp, right along the road here," Nellist reminded the colonel as they hovered over Musi's topo map.
7,000?
Musi repeated the figure with obvious dismay spreading over his face. To the northeast, Nellist and Rounceville explained, there loomed an even more immediate threat. Approximately 200 Japanese soldiers were camped in a bamboo grove along the banks of the Kabu River. Their bivouac site was a mere mile away from the POW camp, easily within earshot of any shooting that would ensue during the night's sortie. They were elite Imperial Army troops, the Dokuho 359 Battalion, under the command of Tomeo Oyabu, and they were well equipped with tanks and armored vehicles. Hearing this evening's fireworks, all they'd have to do is cross a wooden bridge spanning the Kabu River and speed a few hundred yards down the main road to the camp. It would be a bloodbath. The final piece of the puzzle was the most crucial, and it was the piece the Alamo scouts lacked. What exactly was the situation inside the enclosure? The scouts had learned a few spotty details from guerrillas, who nonchalantly snooped along the fence in civilian clothes, posing as farmers. There appeared to be about 70 armed guards staying inside the camp, and it was obvious that substantial numbers of transient Japanese troops were also sleeping there. How many was unclear, and the number fluctuated every night, but their best guess was around 100. At last count, four tanks had been seen entering the compound, as well as an assortment of other heavy vehicles, yet nobody was sure where they were housed. This paucity of intelligence infuriated the colonel. He paced and brooded and fidgeted with his pipe. The raid was in peril. "We have to know more," he shouted. "A lot more." He stripped off his sunglasses to reveal bloodshot eyes, seething with exasperated alarm. "We can get it, sir," Lieutenant Nellist replied confidently. "We need more time." "Don't have time," Musi said, his jaw clenched. When it came to intelligence gathering, the Alamo scouts were supposed to be the elite of the elite. Kruger's darlings, his eyes and ears. But so far, Musi was unimpressed. "Look," he said, "I don't care how you do it, just go back there and get the goods." Feeling chastened, Nellist and Rouncival arrowed back to Platero to redouble their efforts.